Good day, and welcome to the What's Next? Prospects for Campaigns Finance Reform Following McCutcheon v. SEC conference call. Today's conference is being recorded, and at this time I'd like to turn the presentation over to your host, Katie O'Connor. Please go ahead.
Thanks, and hello, everyone. I'm Katie O'Connor, the Assistant Director of Lawyer Chapters here at the American Constitution Society. Thanks so much for joining us for today's call, Prospects for Campaign Finance Reform Following McCutcheon v. SEC. This is the sixth and final call in our summer series of What's Next calls, where experts in our network discuss the past U.S. Supreme Court term. 0.5 hours of CLE credit is available for this and all the calls in series, so please email me at koconnor@acslaw.org to get credit or with any questions about CLE. Before we get to the calls, and for those not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. We're very fortunate that today's speaker is an active part of that network. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and you're not already a formal part of our network, I encourage you to become a member of ACS today. And now I'm pleased to introduce today's speaker, Liz Kennedy. Liz is an attorney and advocate at Demos, where she focuses on campaign finance reforms to increase transparency and accountability for money in politics and to fight democratic corruption. She also works to expand political participation and prevent voter disenfranchisement across the country by eliminating barriers to voting. Prior to joining Demos, Liz was an attorney in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, working on issues of money in politics, democratic accountability, and corporate governance responses to Citizens United. Liz served as Deputy Director of Voter Protection for the 2008 Obama campaign in Ohio and formerly worked as a litigation associate at Cravath, Swain & Moore. She also worked on Arizona Free Enterprise versus Bennett, one of the Supreme Court's most recent campaign finance cases, and she co-authored an amicus brief in McCutcheon v. FEC. She's a good friend to ACS and a great advocate on behalf of American voters. And now I'll hand it over to Liz, who will speak for a few minutes or so before we open it up for questions.
Great. Thank you, Katie, and thank you to ACS for organizing this call and inviting me to speak about money and politics reform after McCutcheon v. FEC. One of the first modern political bosses from the first Gilded Age famously quipped that there are two things that are important in politics. The first is money, and I can't remember the second. But demos means the people, and it's the root word of democracy. And we think that people should be the most important thing in politics. People's needs, people's voices, and people's dignity. We believe that we should all have an equal say in our democracy and an equal chance in our economy, and we're all stronger when that comes to pass. But right now, the improper influence of money in our politics and policymaking has led our government to be dependent on, and thus responsive to, only a tiny fraction of the wealthiest Americans. This court's radical deregulatory stance in First Amendment and campaign finance law is twisting the Constitution and leaving us without the power to protect our democratic self-government from domination by the donor class. We're in a vicious cycle where the interests of the economically privileged are privileged in our political process. And this isn't really just a kind of too bad, so sad question about whether the world is fair. This is a question of who gets their voice heard and their preferences registered, and it goes to the heart of our constitutional system of representative democracy. When the new golden rule is that he who has the gold makes the rules, that is a big problem for democratic legitimacy. In his McCutcheon dissent, Justice Breyer explained that, quote, taken together with Citizens United, today's decision eviscerates our nation's campaign finance laws, leaving a remnant incapable of dealing with the grave problems of democratic legitimacy that those laws were intended to resolve. So, what is Breyer concerned about? Let's set the stage with some numbers. More than $6 billion was spent in the 2012 elections, and the degree to which a tiny fraction of the U.S. population dominates contributions and spending in support of candidates has shot up. The Sunlight Foundation reported in the 2012 elections, quote, candidates got more money from a smaller percentage of the population than for any year for which they had data. We found that the money spent by just 32 super PAC donors, giving an average of $10 million each, was enough to outspend all of the money that came from all of the small donors to the Obama and Romney campaigns combined. And that's at least 3.7 million people. Only less than one half of 1% of Americans gave contributions in 2012 of over $200, and we know that the donor class is substantially whiter at 96%, maler at 70%, and older, with 70% being over 50 years old, than the voting population. So there are lots of other numbers that we could discuss, but what's more important than the numbers is thinking about the power, because that is what's at stake when we talk about money in politics. The power to make your voice heard in the contest to make the rules for our society. So, the McCutcheon case is another assault on our ability to protect our democratic government by domination by the donor class. In this case, energy executive Sean McCutcheon and the Republican National Committee got the court to declare for the first time that the Constitution no longer allows total contribution limits for federal elections. In McCutcheon v. FEC, the court's conservative majority doubled down on its Citizens United mistakes. They said that there is not enough of a risk of corruption or its appearance from multi-million dollar checks going straight between contributors and elected representatives to justify total contribution limits, so they struck them down. And this was the very first time that they struck down federal contribution limits. So now, instead of a limit for what an individual could contribute of only upwards of $125,000, which was already twice as much as the average income of the American of an American household, now an individual can write a check for $3.5 million, or some say even $5.9 million if they wanted to max out to both parties, directly to the candidates' parties and political committees. And Demos, in fact, predicts that this McCutcheon money, from striking the limits, will bring in more than $1 billion in additional campaign contributions from elite donors through 2020. So I think an important question to look at is really how the court has establish this jurisprudence that is, in many people's views, utterly separate from the actual reality of practices on the ground. The court, in both McCutcheon and Citizens United, was asked to determine the potential factual implications here of striking the limits almost entirely in the abstract. And Breyer's dissent points out that the majority's, quote, conclusion rests upon its own and not a record-based view of the facts. So it's only been a few months since the McCutcheon decision came down, and we'll have to await more information as to the effects of that decision over time. But it's clear from the report recently released by Professor Dan Takagi and Renata Strauss, entitled The New Soft Money, that the court blinked reality in Citizens United when they held that independent expenditures were not corrupting as a matter of law. The report finds that, in fact, independent expenditures drive the agenda. So the court relied on the presumption of independence, and yet Takagi and Strauss report a campaign operative as saying, today it's all kind of a fiction. It's just kind of a farce, the whole campaign finance non-coordination thing. Operatives describe using, quote, smoke signals to indicate needs and strategies, for example, through the use of B-roll photographs and publicly released polling and talking points. In fact, the Campaign Legal Center challenged the use of campaign-created B-roll, charging that it counts as a republication of campaign materials and is therefore an illegal in-kind contribution to the beneficiary campaign. And the way that fundraising practices have adapted to the new rules also belies claims of independence that would assuage corruption concerns. Federal candidates and office holders are currently allowed to, quote, attend, speak at, and be featured guests at fundraisers for outside groups that accept unlimited money, even from corporations and unions that aren't allowed to give to candidates at all. Basically, these candidates or office holders just have to give a disclaimer that they're personally only soliciting money within the federal hard money limits, but then they can go off stage while, you know, the big checks are actually requested. In fact, the report also lists other practices, such as candidates making fundraising calls to maxed out donors, providing lists of big donors to outside spending groups, and there are reports that these candidates and then elected representatives see the list of donors to outside groups as well. We should also mention the rise of single candidate super PACs, which continues to grow and is projected to be a booming industry. When we look at where this argument, where the line really lies between what is acknowledged cooperation that stays outside of the extremely constrained legal definition of coordination. And, of course, this matters because if these were held to be coordinated, they would actually be contributions that were under the still existing federal contribution limits. And instead, it was the premise of independence that allowed the court to rule that they would be entirely impossible to be corrupting and therefore allowed lower courts to strike all contribution limits to those groups that are doing these purportedly independent spendings. It really is to do such a violence to words when they run counter to their common sense meaning. And I think we should all keep that in mind, and we'll return to that when we look at the changing view of corruption throughout the court's modern campaign finance jurisdiction, jurisprudence. So this paper concludes, of all their findings, perhaps the most important is the impact of this purportedly independent spending on governance. And that lines up with what Justice Breyer was explaining in his McCutcheon dissent, that, quote, speech does not exist in a vacuum. Political communication seeks to secure government action. Now, why does this matter? So, in fact, that is the way that political communication is understood by political players, that it seeks to secure government action. The new soft money report quotes a lobbyist who said about the motivations of donors, there is no question that money creates relationships. The large contributions enable them to establish relationships that increase the chances they'll be successful with their public policy agenda. Senator Nelson was quoted as saying that some outside spenders have unhealthy expectations of the elected officials they assist. And Senator Kent Conrad said of big spenders that, quote, they're certainly going to have someone's ear. In fact, one former representative put it this way. So is the risk there? Obviously. Are there going to be people that are influenced in a way that they might not otherwise be? Obviously. But the court's whole campaign finance jurisprudence has been based on the idea that money in politics can be an improper influence. Justice Kennedy wrote in Citizens United that, quote, if elected officials succumb to improper influences, if they surrender their best judgment, and if they put expediency before principle, then surely there is cause for concern. But today's current conservative majority, it's a legitimate question to ask if they even recognize an outside limit for what they would accept as proper influence for big money supporters. So, why does this matter? Americans already believe that their elected representatives are more responsive to big donors than to voters, and they're right. Research shows that our government responds to the policy preferences of the donor class even when they are very different than the majority of Americans. In fact, the donor class has very different priorities than average-earning Americans, particularly on economic issues. For example, over a quarter of the general public said unemployment was the most important problem in early 2011, but only 11% of the wealthy agreed. And instead, we saw a conversation frequently about an austerity agenda. This is also illustrated by the gap between what voters and donors want for the minimum wage. 78% of Americans, including over 50% of Republican voters, wants the minimum wage to be high enough to keep a family out of poverty. Less than half of the donor class agree with that statement. And we see Congress voting more times to slash taxes on unearned wealth than to give working Americans a raise. This research shows that if the donor class wants something different from working and middle class voters, it's the donor class that wins. As Princeton political science Martin Gillens writes, the American government does respond to the public's preferences, but that responsiveness is strongly tilted towards the most affluent citizens. Indeed, under most circumstances, he writes, the preferences of the vast majority of Americans appear to have essentially no impact on which policies the government does or doesn't adopt. The point is, it matters who our elected representatives are hearing from and listening to, who has access to and influence with them, and who they're dependent on. And they hear much more from some interests than others. It's estimated that elected officials spend 4 to 6 hours a day fundraising. In fact, you may have seen a memo leaked just this week showing that a Senate candidate was instructed to spend 80% of her time fundraising. And these fundraising pressures have consequences. As former Representative Holden said, as quoted in the Newsoff Money Report, quote, "You miss out on what you should be doing. Concentrating on the committees you serve on and meeting your constituents and doing that. You know, you're spending all that time down at the DCCC or the RNC on the phone, and it's not very productive for the citizens of the country, but you have to do it." And what are they doing? U.S. Senator Chris Murphy explains in a process that he referred to as, quote, soul-crushing, that he's generally calling people making at least $500,000. He says, quote, "I talked a lot more about carried interest inside that call room than I did in the supermarket. The people I'm calling have fundamentally different problems than other people. And in Connecticut, especially, you spend a lot of time on the phone with people in the financial markets. So you're hearing a lot about problems that bankers have and not a lot of problems that people who work at the mill in Thomastead, Connecticut have. You certainly have to check yourself." So occasionally people say that, you know, campaign finance is going to get fixed when there's some big scandal. But the real scandal is what is legal right now. So let's spend our final minutes talking about why this is legal and how we've gotten into this mess. As President Franklin Delano Roosevelt stated, government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. Americans have long recognized this and have been passing laws for a century and structuring our Constitution, many would argue, with the anti-corruption principle right smack in the middle, to understand that we want to set up a structure where representatives owe their best loyalty to the interests of the people and not to any particular faction, not the rich more than the poor, for example. Americans have been working to protect our government from being overpowered by organized money and to fight for an equal say in our democracy. Occasionally, the people fight hard enough to get government to actually pass these laws regulating the use of money in politics. But the Supreme Court, for the last 40 years, and then particularly now really in the last almost 5 years, or, well, prior to Citizens United as well, but has been ruling these laws unconstitutional, saying that the law burdens the First Amendment right too much and without sufficient reason from the government. But unfortunately, in decisions leading up to Citizens United, we've seen the Supreme Court removing a host of legislative powers from the people and their representatives to enact common sense political spending regulations. And now the current Supreme Court under Chief Justice Roberts is going after really the foundations of campaign finance law. So, taking a step back, as we know, 40 years ago, the court said that since political speech is important and protected by the First Amendment, and since money can be used to make more political speech, then using money for political speech is protected by the First Amendment. Colloquially, that has come down to us as money equals speech. Another thing the court did in the first modern money and politics case in Buckley was to distinguish between contribution and spending limits. The court struck down the spending limits but upheld the limits on contributions because they found that, quote, "limitations on money and politics prevent the real or imagined coercive influence of large financial contributions on candidates' positions and on their actions if elected to office." Another thing the Buckley court said was that the proper justification for government passing the laws that burden political speech was to fight corruption or the appearance of corruption. But in the last 40 years, the court has gone back and forth on what a lot of this means. So, for example, in the case from 2000, the court Nixon v. Shrink, Missouri, the court considered the meaning of what kind of corruption the government could properly fight through rules for money and politics. They held that, quote, or rather that corruption of government is, quote, "not confined to bribery of public officials, but extends to the broader threat from politicians too compliant with the wishes of large contributions." In fact, the court recognized the importance of campaign rules, campaign finance rules, saying that, quote, by limiting the size of the largest contributions, such restrictions aim to democratize the influence that money itself may bring to bear upon the electoral process. It was in that same case of Nixon that former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens reminded us of the court's first fundamental error. He wrote, quote, money is property, it is not speech. Continuing, quote, speech has the power to inspire volunteers to perform a multitude of tasks on the campaign trail, on a battleground, and even on a football field. Meanwhile, money has the power to pay hired laborers to perform the same tasks. It does not follow, however, that the First Amendment provides the same measure of protection to the use of money to accomplish such goals as it provides to the use of ideas to achieve the same results. So we should pause and think about that for a moment, because we know that there are some things that money isn't supposed to be able to buy. You can't buy more time to argue your case in front of the Supreme Court, for example. But right now, big money donors can buy more influence with your and my elected representatives, and therefore more influence on the policies of our actual government. So, even considering the importance of the freedom of speech, there are all sorts of circumstances where we limit speech. For example, yelling fire in a crowded theater, or blaring your opinion through loudspeakers in the park at midnight. That's because even though these rules limit speech, the government has a good reason to protect public safety and welfare. And here, we have good reasons for protecting our democracy. So, in the McConnell case, the court earlier had recognized that the government needs the power to make these rules to protect our democracy, saying, quote, take away Congress's authority to regulate the appearance of undue influence, and the cynical assumption that large donors call the tune could jeopardize the willingness of voters to take part in democratic government. The Supreme Court there upheld the law challenged because they found that corruption of government is, quote, not confined to bribery of public officials, but extends to the broader threat from politicians too compliant with the wishes of large contributors. The possibility that legislators would, quote, decide issues not on the merits or the desires of their constituencies, but according to the wishes of those who have made large financial contributions valued by the officeholder, is a more subtle form of corruption than straight quid pro quo transactions, they said, but is equally dispiriting. So this is where we were when the court in McConnell actually had a record in front of it where they were able to take into account the testimonies of actual political players as to how the use of money in the political process was affecting themselves and the outcome of legislation and elected races. Citizens United changed all that. It turned the corner in what Professor Fran Hill has described as the Roberts Court's move in its money and politics jurisprudence away from a, quote, democratic integrity framework with a, quote, public participation agenda, which was evident in Austin and McConnell, to a, quote, political speech framework with, quote, a corporate political speech agenda. So, I will also pause when speaking about the corporate political speech to recall Austin. Importantly, Citizens United also rejected the Supreme Court's prior understanding that the government has particular justification to regulate political spending by corporations. In that case, Austin v. Michigan Chamber of Commerce, the court held that the government had a compelling interest to protect our democracy from, quote, the corrosive and distorting effects of immense aggregations of wealth that are accumulated with the help of the corporate form and that have little or no correlation with the public support for the corporation's political ideas. The Supreme Court held that corporations, quote, present the potential for distorting the political process, end quote. And since this would be a corruption of democracy, the government could pass laws to control it. But now the court has rejected this view and now narrowed their understanding of corruption such that it truly beggars reality. The Supreme Court has concluded, without evidence, that independent spending, even by corporations, doesn't corrupt, ignoring that ingratiation, loyalty, access, and influence are the coin of the realm in politics. Justice Kennedy was just wrong when he wrote that ingratiation and access in any event are not corruption. Moreover, showing a serious tenure to our times, the court also decided that, quote, the appearance of influence or access, furthermore, will not cause the electorate to lose faith in our democracy. In reality, over 80% of Americans, huge bipartisan majorities, disagree with the court's view that only quid pro quo, basically bribery, is a corruption of government. Americans know that when financial supporters have more access and influence with members of Congress than average Americans, then that, too, is a corruption of democratic government. 57% of Americans say it is very corrupt when financial supporters have more access and influence with members of Congress than average Americans. At this point, only 10% of Americans have confidence in Congress, and 80% believe that elected officials are more responsive to the interests of their big contributors than to their constituents or even the public interest. Only the court is blind to the crisis of confidence in American democracy today. Under John Roberts, the Supreme Court has struck down every campaign finance law that comes before them on the grounds that they're protecting free speech. But whose freedom and whose speech? There was a series of really excellent editorial cartoons that came out in response to the McCutcheon decision, and one of my favorite was a cartoon titled Justice John Roberts Again Defends the Lower Classes, which parodied the decision by showing a suited man standing under a bridge, pronouncing to the family huddled there, "Just wanted to assure you, the court has protected your right to give unlimited funds to the candidates of your choice." This Supreme Court would construct an Anatole France constitution that, in its majesty, forbids the rich and poor alike from sleeping under bridges and begging for money in the streets. The court has turned its back on the reality of money in politics and its impact on our society, and ignores the reality of the improper influence and the dependence of representatives on these big money donors. We really have to, and this is while these networks of entrenched special interests are seizing every opportunity to exploit each new loophole to exert more power while the court continues to dismantle our money in politics protections. So, let's say it as plainly as possible. The First Amendment does not give anyone the right to buy the American government. But that's the course that the Supreme Court has set us on. They've adopted such a warped view that it endangers our democratic republic in the name of freedom of speech. As Justice Breyer wrote in his dissent in McCutcheon, the First Amendment advances not only the individual's right to engage in political speech, but also the public's interest in preserving a democratic order in which collective speech matters. This is because, as Justice Breyer continued, a fundamental principle of our constitutional system is the maintenance of the opportunity for free political discussion to the end, that government may be responsive to the will of the people. Breyer concludes, speech does not exist in a vacuum. Political communication seeks to secure government action. So we know that the Roberts Court is ignoring the way this deregulated money in politics is stacking the deck and leading to a government less responsive to the American people. And we know that as long as our elected representatives are dependent on the wealthiest elite for the money to get reelected, they will be less responsive than they should be to the people and the people's interests. After all, a point that was made in Jamie Raskin's testimony to the Senate in support of the constitutional amendment hearing, the power to spend unlimited money in politics is also the power for unlimited threats and unlimited promises. And our current system for funding campaigns leaves representatives running around hat in hand, beggars, not rulers. The new soft money reports that things have changed since Citizens United, and now members of Congress are scared to death that they may get hit by the outside. So, just as famed bank robber John Dellinger said when asked why he robbed banks, because that's where the money is, our representatives go to our country's wealthiest because that's where the money is that they need for their reelection. So we need to change this dynamic by working together to demand new solutions so democracy is not dominated by the wealthiest few. In a democracy, the power and authority must rest with the people, so we need to remember to ask the big questions. What is government for? For whose interest does it work? what does it mean in a democracy for us all to be political equals, and how do we structure our rules for the use of money in politics so that the size of your wallet doesn't determine the strength of your voice? Fortunately, there really are solutions that are eminently reachable today, in the short term, in the midterm, and then in the long term, there is more than one path forward to retake government, and so that it is not captured by a dominant donor class. So in the interest of having a discussion, I will briefly go through some of the main solutions. And I'll just start with disclosure as kind of the lowest hanging fruit. In fact, there used to be a common normative understanding that sunlight was the best disinfectant, and in fact a bipartisan agreement. There are many, many, many quotes from Republicans who previously supported disclosure, including Senator Mitch McConnell. But now we are in Congress currently facing something of a standoff. If you just saw a hearing just last week on the Disclose Act to try to get actual effective disclosure of the underlying source of funds. Right now, we have seen an explosion in dark money. Secret political spending is up over $300 million in the 2012 cycle. And as of mid-July, Demos actually just put out a report using CRP's numbers showing that as of mid-July, dark political spending in this midterm cycle was already 15 times more than the non-disclosed political spending in the last midterms, and already three times as much as the 2012 cycle. The Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld disclosure requirements because they provide information voters need to judge a message and can make informed decisions so that voters can make informed decisions as well as exercise accountability over candidates and financial supporters. So transparency is necessary to fight corruption and to inform voters. We should also note here that currently corporations and unions are not at all similarly situated when it comes to disclosure. Unions are required to disclose all of their political spending to the Department of Labor, which is then made public, whereas unions are in the tax category of C5, whereas 501c4s, which people have probably heard of as these purportedly social welfare, but now kind of these newly political nonprofits, and then 501c6s, which are, of course, the organized business interests, they have combined to engage in this new dark spending, and we don't know how much of the $300 million may be coming directly from publicly traded corporations or which ones. Shareholders currently don't have the right to that information, but it is the responsibility of the Securities and Exchange Commission to require transparency for political spending by publicly traded corporations in the interests of investors and the public. So they've so far failed to act in the face of rising public demand. So we'll see, hopefully they will actually be able to make progress on the rulemaking that was requested by a bipartisan committee of law professors. So Congress could pass a systemic structural improvement to require coherent disclosure of everyone through the Disclose Act. The IRS needs to better crack down on the abuse of the 501c4 nonprofit form, even though the first effort at the rule needed some work, and so the IRS took that back and now will be working on that, and even in the face of the huge amounts of political pressure that was visited upon them for their first attempt to do a job that they inappropriately did, but that they were trying to stop the abuse of these C4 tax-exempt groups to be used as vehicles to essentially bring in dark money to the political system. So, while transparency is important, though, to change the dynamic, we really need reforms that increase the voices of small donors. The Supreme Court recently reaffirmed the constitutionality of public financing in the Arizona case. And so even though the Supreme Court has blocked us from enforcing common sense limits on the use of big money in politics, we remain free to tackle the problem from the other side of the equation, providing incentives to bring more small donors into the system. We can shift the balance of power back towards regular voters by providing additional incentives for non-wealthy citizens to make small contributions and increasing the effect of these small contributions by matching them with public funds. So this provides an incentive for candidates to reach out to their regular constituents instead of just chasing big checks. We've seen matched public financing make legislators more representative and more responsive. For example, in Connecticut, it experienced a marked increase in government victories for regular people after adopting new rules for money in politics. 2008 was the first year that the legislature in Connecticut had a majority of legislators who'd run under the new clean election system, and they report that corporate donors and lobbyists had less sway, candidates spent more time with constituents than dialing for dollars, and the legislature passed a working families agenda with a minimum wage increase, paid sick days, and an in-state DREAM Act, and more. So the Government by the People Act and the Fair Elections Now Act are the best proposals in Congress. The Government by the People Act would provide a 6-to-1 match on contributions up to $150 from a public fund and a refundable tax credit for small donations. We've seen public financing programs be successfully employed in Arizona, in Maine, and in New York City as well, and other places. So that is really the two elements of policy that we can all organize and push for currently. Finally, in the long term, while we need to adopt the policies that are presently constitutional, we must also engage in long-term change to take back the Constitution. So freedom of speech is central to our society, and some things should be unconstitutional. For example, in a system where majorities rule, it's important to prohibit discrimination against a disfavored minority or any discrimination against any particular content or point of view. But in a democracy, we should, through the power of our collective votes, be able to elect representatives who will craft policies that reflect our legitimate policy preferences. Just as the court once trespassed against our right to adopt legal protections for workers and used a theory of, quote, freedom of contract to justify striking down minimum wage laws, so too the Supreme Court is preventing us from exercising our collective right to a democratic government that is responsive to the people. The rules of our economy and democracy are too important to be left to unappointed judges, and it's time to return to a constitutional understanding that empowers people to fight the improper influence of big money so we can have fair representation for all, regardless of wealth. We can take back our Constitution so we can adopt rules that prevent those with economic power from using their financial resources to extract special treatment from those with political power, and so that our representatives are no longer dependent on the economic elite to get elected. The First Amendment and our Constitution are tools for democratic self-government, not for domination of democracy by the donor class. And if, in fact, we are unable through the current judiciary, although we have absolutely seen instances where the current judiciary is opining against, even while feeling controlled by some of the current money and politics decision, Judge Calabrese in the Agnobene dissent, decision, his concurrence in that case, saying that it's only a matter of time until the court's rejection of the anti-distortion rationale is overturned, essentially, and really looking at the communicative value and the importance of the First Amendment elements of that. So there's an important path through the courts, and I hope that that is something that all of the lawyers joining me on this call will take, give some thought to and think seriously about how to write about and participate in these growing debates. And if we cannot reclaim the Constitution through the courts, we will continue to organize to amend the Constitution to clarify that the people have the power to protect government from the improper influence of big money. The amendment currently being considered in the Senate is simple. It would give the people, through Congress or state or local governments, the ability to regulate and limit political spending. 16 states and hundreds of localities have already passed resolutions calling for an amendment. It was passed out of the Senate committee and will, in fact, be going to be voted on by the whole Senate this year. And today is actually a national call-in day to call some targeted senators to ask them to support the amendment. So I think, you know, all told, the court has gotten us in a bad position. It is currently leading to a government that in many important ways is anti-majoritarian and not at all responsive, but there are present and future paths forward so that we can reclaim government of, by, and for the people. And with that, I will look forward to talking about these issues and answering some questions.
And if you would like to signal for a question, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're listening via speakerphone, please make sure your mute button is off or you pick up the handset. Once again, that is star 1 for questions at this time.
While we wait to see if anybody has any questions, Liz, I do have one for you. And that's just, aside from a constitutional amendment, is there any wiggle room to further limit spending at this point? Is there any way to get that without a constitutional amendment?
That's a really good question. So when we talk about spending limits, it's important to think about the fact that there are amount restrictions and then also source restrictions. So there are actually, and rather than think necessarily, although that would be a great question, but about our ability to adopt currently further spending limits, I would say our first goal would also to be to defend what few spending limits we actually have on the books. So there is a challenge currently in the Wagner v. SEC case, challenging the government contractor ban. So currently government contractors are not allowed to contribute money to federal campaigns. Currently, corporations and unions are not allowed directly from their treasuries to contribute to candidate campaigns. You know, we expect, and of course, currently foreigners are not allowed to contribute to campaigns, and that was something that was challenged last year in the Daniel Chick litigation. So there are, and there's other moves, perhaps, you know, to adopt new or to bring up to the federal level some other limitations, which is more of a contribution limit, but for example, lobbyist bundling ban or the session solicitation ban that requires members of Congress not to solicit money during, during the session. So I think, they have certainly said, that, you know, because they made this First Amendment distinction between contributions as being something that could be limited because they were indirect political speech, but the current court, well, in modern campaign finance, they moved to say expenditures are core political speech, and because using money is right in there with that right, Justice Roberts famously saying, the First Amendment doesn't only protect the rights of the lonely pamphleteer, for example. So I think we would really have to move to show the court that, in fact, using money to support your political speech is conduct and does not deserve the same amount of First Amendment protection as the speech itself, and therefore we should be able to adopt some spending limits. And also, I mean, the other thing I should say, again, not on the court's current understanding, but when you look at the fundraising pressures and the effects on the use of elected official time and then who that means they are in constant contact with and dependent on, I think that kind of soaring, you know, arms race is really another good reason for spending limits. And, of course, when the Federal Election Campaign Act amendments were adopted, Congress had meant all of these limits to work in tandem with each other. And instead, because we've basically ended up with what Professor Newborn refers to as Frankfurter's nightmare, this kind of Rube Goldberg system of a judge-made set of rules and regulations for the use of money in politics, we really need to get back to a drawing board and devise the best policy situation to separate the use of money from political power.
And we did have some questions on the phone, if we're ready.
Sure.
The first to Howard Wayne at the Attorney General's Office.
Thank you. I'm wondering if one of the positive results of the McCutcheon case might be to redirect money from the secret PACs, that is the 501c4s, to what is a reportable contribution to members of Congress.
Sure. Thanks for raising that question. That is certainly something that people have posited. I would say that that may very well not comport with the reality that sophisticated political players are now very much intending, are fundraising off of their promise that we can keep your identities secret. We've seen reports of that. So while we expect that many more people who use the avenue of the hard money contributions may increase and just give, you know, Sean McCutcheon's special number was 1776, right? He could have given $1,000 to all of the candidates he professed to be interested in, but he specifically wanted to use his special number of 1776, a point Ruth Bader Ginsburg made at oral argument. So he may just donate that to a few more people. But once this cat is out of the bag, essentially, the reports taken from, reflected in the New Soft Money report, are such that while some hold that as a possible positive, that in fact it really will just probably mean more of all of the money, both going through the hard money and then now what is not accidentally referred to as the new soft money outside spending channels, many of which will remain dark until government patches that problem, because that in fact now serves some of these donors' interests.
And we'll go next to David Schwartz.
Hi. The question is whether you're aware of the possibility that these kinds of large-scale spendings might be enlisted in the future on the side of progressives and leftists, taking into account the possibility of some individuals having received or being in the process of not receiving deferred pay, which is lying latently unused. For example, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I would just say, so I'm not quite sure I'm clear on your deferred pay point, but to address the larger question, my concern here is not partisan. Yes, it is true that twice as much outside money goes to support Republicans than Democrats, but that is not my concern. So whether the money is coming in on the left or the right, the real issue is that the money is causing our government to be responsive to the views of those with the money. And then you can look at social science reports that say that, in fact, the top 10%, that was as close as they could cut it, but the top 10%, which was referred to in the donor as the donor class in this study by Ben Page, they just have very different views on a whole cut of issues and very starkly on economic issues. So it's really a question of kind of the anti-majoritarian and anti-democratic elements when a representative who in a representative democracy ought to be acting in the interests of their constituents or acting in the interests of the general public interest as they understand it or acting in the exercise of their own judgment. But they ought not to be putting any of those things aside because they are, in fact, acting in the interests, however that is communicated to them, of their donors and or the folks that they're afraid will come in and have either threatened them explicitly or that they implicitly understand will come in and spend against them if they don't toe the line. So it's really the anti-majoritarian, anti-democratic effects that we see playing out in the total misalignment of public policy outcomes with the public policy preferences of Americans, that is my concern.
And we'll go next to George Schumann.
Thank you. I'm in Kentucky, and we have a dandy Senate race going on that demonstrates the infusion of a lot of money from outside Kentucky to influence the race. But my question really relates to the process of amending the Constitution in a way that would be remedial and effective. And I'd like you to, if you would, contrast the present pending Senator Udall's amendment, which authorizes Congress to regulate campaign finance, but the word is in there to reasonably regulate.
Mm-hmm.
Versus something explicit like the move to amend amendment that in the body of the amendment says some things that are troubling about corporations shall have no rights under the Constitution. I'm concerned that a Roberts-like court could take this reasonableness thing and do what they have done to campaign finance already and just say, you know, Congress, you passed a law restricting money, and but unreasonably so. So if you would contrast, you know, the way forward for a constitutional amendment, what would be, in your judgment, the most effective way? Does it need to be explicit, or does it just need to authorize Congress to do something that under present circumstances would be very difficult to do?
Sure. I think that those are all very good points, and that this is there's been a process where various groups, a lot of groups in the field, you know, have been working to come together around a common language and have landed on the Udall Amendment, and then at the hearing, at one of the hearings where the Congressional, the Senate Committee was considering this regulation, there was the move to include the word reasonable. I was going to actually mention that up top, but decided there was enough to be getting on with. So I personally think that that is probably a good thing. Let me put it this way. No Supreme Court is made up in its own vacuum. No amendment should be understood in its own vacuum. This is all part of the politics of our polity over time. You know, much as we had the switch in time that saved nine, you know, once the folks who were really not doing well because the court kept striking down these very fundamental, what we have, you know, come to recognize as foundational powers to regulate the economy for the safety and public welfare of the public, right? So the Lochner era, kind of a what not to do constitutionally, except that we're seeing it replayed here in the money and politics realm. So not to evade what is a very good question about the actual language, and, of course, a lot of these constitutional, you know, a lot of the groups moving these amendments wanted very much to include a specific element saying, corporations shall not be deemed to have the same corporate, the same constitutional rights as people, which is different, by the way, than saying that corporations shall not have any statutory rights. You know, it's actually a very different thing. That is something that people can kind of elide to say, well, if they don't have corporate rights, then, oh, these poor big corporations. Judge Nelson in the Montana Supreme Court case, in which he actually dissented from the decision that upheld Montana's state ban on corporate spending, he said, I feel I'm controlled by the Citizens United precedent that I can't read as saying anything other than we can't keep our corporate ban. But he said, few people prior to Citizens United would have thought that corporations not having enough power in American politics was really the problem. So I think that we can't necessarily do all things with this one amendment, and that there are important – excuse me? It's no small thing to amend the Constitution, particularly when it touches on the First Amendment. But I think that the Udall Amendment, as currently constituted, should have a very strong record built about what exactly is intended to mean that people should have the power to regulate these things, and we should debate what is reasonable within those conversations if, in fact, we are able to move towards that amendment if the court does not recognize its folly and, in fact, really go another way, recognizing that the First Amendment shouldn't be read in abstraction and in isolation, but rather as part of a, you know, man-made constitution meant to serve men, and then more men, and then women, and then, that it's not meant to be a tool for collapsing that democracy.
Okay, well, I think that was our last question. Liz, thank you so much, and thanks to all the participants for joining us on today's call. I just want to invite you all briefly to participate in next Thursday's 4 p.m. call with Sarah Bronstein from the Catholic Legal Immigration Network and Kristen Jackson from Public Counsel. They'll be discussing the unaccompanied child migrant crisis and how you can help. Information is on our website, and thanks again, everyone, for participating. Have a great day.
And this does conclude today's presentation. We thank everyone for their participation.